Chabad Danurg Audio.
This lecture is presented by Rabbi Eliezer Gurkov, Rabbi at Congregation Beth Tfilah in London, Ontario.
Rabbi Yehuda is the seventh generation from Hillel. And so we started our talk with Hillel, we'll end with Rabbi Yehuda. It was Hillel and his son was Gamliel, his son was Shimon ben Gamliel, his son was Gamliel ben Shimon, his son was Shimon ben Gamliel, and then finally they broke the chain and called him Yehuda. Although Rabbi Yehuda did his grandfather a favor and went back to Gamliel, whose son went back to Yehuda. So Hillel, as I mentioned, had spawned a dynasty of 15 generations. Rabbi Yehuda was more or less at the center, number 7. And he's known as Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the prince, because he inherited the position that was given to Hillel and maintained in that dynasty throughout, the position of Nasi, the president of the Jewish people. I've explained before this was a president concerned primarily with spiritual concerns and the education of the people and the observance of the halacha. He's also known as Rabbi Yehuda HaKadosh, the holy Rabbi Yehuda. We'll talk about that in a moment. And he's known also simply and lovingly as Rabbi, because he is the teacher par excellence. When he's quoted in the book, in the Ethics of Our Fathers, in the beginning of chapter 2, a very ethical teaching of one should always be certain that one's behavior is pleasing both to God and to man. That's Rebbe's teaching. He's not quoted as Rabbi Yehuda, he's quoted simply as Rebbe. And he's often referred to as Rebbe. He is the Rebbe of the Jewish people because it was his initiative that wrote the Mishnah that literally preserved the Torah for us today. So he continues to be our Rebbe. If not for his documentation of the Mishnah, there is a good chance once again that the Torah would not have survived. This has become a theme in our discussions throughout the last 3-4 weeks, because it was such a difficult era of history, and without the aid of documentation, none of the Torah could have survived, because they were relying literally upon the transmission of Torah from one mouth to another. Until Rabbi Yehuda came along and took advantage of a relative lull in the pressure, and used that opportunity to write the Mishnah. So we'll talk a little more about that as we go on. Rebbe was born in the year 134 or 135 and lived for 100 years. Now the Talmud says that the day Rebbe Akiva passed away, the day he was executed, is the day Rebbe was born. That means Rebbe was born on Yom Kippur, according to the tradition we mentioned last week that Rebbe Akiva was executed on Yom Kippur. The Talmud tells, actually the Midrash tells an interesting story about Rebbe Yehuda's circumcision. Being born during that era, again, right after the crushing of the Bar Kokhba revolt, one of the decrees of Hadrian, the Hadrianic decrees as they are known, was not only a prohibition against public Torah study, but a prohibition against circumcision. So naturally his father, the Nasi, the president of the Jewish people, circumcised his son. But when the circumcision police came around, which was common, his mother was on very friendly terms with one of the wives of the Roman governors in Israel, and so she too had a baby at that time, so they swapped their newborn babies for a couple of days. And when they brought the baby to the circumcision police, the baby was clearly not circumcised. And after the danger had passed, they swapped the babies back again. This little baby went on to become a person the Talmud refers to as Antoninus. And though historians are not certain exactly which Antoninus this was, there's a good supposition or a good suspicion that falls upon Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, because he lived during the same time as Rabbi Yehuda, and the Talmud refers to him as the king. And there, according to one version of the Talmud, Marcus Aurelius secretly converted. But according to all versions in the Talmud, he studied Torah with Rabbi Yehuda and was certainly on great friendly terms. And in their own succinct way, the rabbis of the Talmud blame his affinity toward Judaism on the 3 days of kosher milk that he nursed from Rabbi Yehuda's mother during the days of the swap. The background. His ancestry explained that he was a descendant of Hillel himself. His teachers, Rabbi Yehuda, actually studied with each of the students of Rabbi Akiva and also with some others. It seems as if his father deliberately groomed him for the task at hand of writing the Mishnah, trying to accumulate all of the teachings of Rabbi Akiva. And I explained last week that Rabbi Akiva was the holder of Torah in his generation. He was the last person who survived who was able to transmit the teachings of the previous generation. And here Rabbi Yehuda went on to learn from each of his of Rabbi Akiva's students. Rabbi Yehuda also shared memories of his studies with Rabbi Meir that I shared with you before, that he saw Rabbi Meir from behind. He said of Rabbi Lazar ben Shamua, another one of Rabbi Akiva's students, that there were so many students and yet so little space that in every amma, in every cubit, roughly 1.5 feet, there were 6 students that sat crushed together, literally like sardines. He was in Tekoa, where Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai had a yeshiva, and so he literally studied with all of them, with Rabbi Yossi as well. I mentioned Rabbi Yossi as one of Rabbi Meir's colleagues. With Rabbi Yossi, he would say, whenever he asked a question of Rabbi Yossi's teachings, he would say, who are we to ask? If Rabbi Yossi's generation is like the Holy of Holies, then we are like the mundane of mundane, the weekday of weekdays. But still, Rebbe was such, humble as he was, he would ask the question, and often disagreed as well. His colleagues, one of his famous colleagues is Rabbi Lazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. The Talmud tells a story that one day Rabbi Lazar, sitting with him together in front of their teachers, one of the teachers was in fact Rabbi Yehuda's father, and the two of them were asking such brilliant questions that the teachers said they don't deserve to sit on the floor, they should sit up on a chair. In those days, students sat on the floor, teachers sat up on chairs. So they sat them both up on the chairs. So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says of his son Rabbi Yehuda, what, do you want to kill my little son by showing him off in front of everyone and attracting the ayin hara, the evil eye? And so they had Rabbi Yehuda sit on the ground. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha said, and we mentioned last week that there is some argument that he was a son of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, because Karcha means bald, and Rabbi Akiva was bald, so perhaps they referred to him as Rabbi Yeshua, the son of the bald one. And they didn't want to say his father's name because his father was executed. And there was a danger for the executed person's son to take a prominent position in the community. So they referred to him by code. So this Rabbi Yeshua said, you're going to protect Rabbi Yehuda, but not Rabbi Lazar, just because his father is not here to argue for him, to defend him. And so they both sat on the floor together. And Rabbi Lazar then took offense. You're going to compare my Torah knowledge to Yehuda's Torah knowledge. So he started asking questions and proving Rabbi Yehuda to be, in comparison to himself, an ignoramus. And Rabbi Yehuda felt bad and he went back to his father and said, what did I do to deserve this kind of treatment? And so his father said to him, listen, I know I'm the president, but I don't compare to his father, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. You are like a lion, the son of a fox. And he is like the lion, the son of a lion. Rabbi Yehuda always remembered his father's response and said, my father was a very humble man. Among his students were some of the greatest names of the following generation, including Rav and Shmuel, who became, again, the beginning of the era of the Gemara, which followed the era of the Mishnah. Moving forward, Rabbi Yehuda was a very, very wealthy man. It says that both his table and the table of Marcus Aurelius always boasted cucumber, lettuce, and mushroom in all seasons. Today we're accustomed to that, but in those days that was considered a delicacy. The sages were so impressed with his wealth that they said from Moshe till Rabbi Yehuda, I'm sorry, it was supposed to read from Moshe till Rabbi Yehuda, there was never such an accumulation of Torah and wealth on one table. And it was said that the groom of Rabbi Yehuda's horses was wealthier than Shavur Malka, than the kings and queens of various provinces and countries around that area. And people would say that we'd rather have the fertilizer of the orchards in Rabbi Yehuda's house than the silver and gold of kings and queens. In other words, a demonstration of Rabbi Yehuda's incredible wealth. What did he do with some of that wealth? Well, he supported his students. We are told that Rabbi Chiya, who was one of his primary pupils, literally lived in Rabbi Yehuda's house and ate off of his table. We are also told of an occasion where Rabbi Yehuda had a grand party and a meal, and he invited all of his students, and he offered tongue, and some tongue was well done, and some tongue was rare, and the students had a selection, so he really looked after his students. During the time of famine, Rabbi Yehuda opened the doors and said, all scholars of Torah are welcome to come and eat. So he had one scholar by the name of Yonatan ben Amram, who said, I don't want to be fed on the merit of my Torah study. And so he went to Rabbi Yehuda and he disguised himself and he said, I'm not a Torah scholar, but I'm hungry. Can you feed me, please? Rabbi Yehuda said, on what basis should I feed you? What is the merit? He said, feed me like God feeds the stray dogs and the ravens. And so Rabbi Yehuda said, fine, I'll feed you. And then later he felt badly. Did I do the right thing? I fed a person with no merit. And so his son said to him, maybe this was the famous Yonatan who hates to take advantage of his Torah status. And so they discovered it was him. And Rabbi Yehuda said, Yonatan, you taught me a lesson. Open the doors, let everybody come in. The daughters of Elisha, that famous Elisha, came and they said to Rabbi Yehuda, feed us. He said, but your father was the heretic. And they said to him, feed us on the basis of his Torah, not on the basis of his actions. Rabbi Yehuda cried. He was very susceptible to tears. On many occasions he broke down and cried, and he said, if this is how we speak of such scholars, then how great is the reward of those whose actions literally follow through with their Torah study. And of course, yes, he did feed them. He honored the wealthy. The people who were wealthy were respected by Rabbi Yehuda. And why? Well, maybe we can argue that Rabbi Yehuda's great-great-great-grandfather Hillel once said that the more possessions you own, the more worries you have. Now, why would a person want to enter into such worries? Only, of course, so that you can provide for those who have less than you and provide for those who need jobs. So that you would decide to invest your time and your life to accumulate possessions and to undertake all these worries only so that you can provide for those who have less. That was something that Rabbi Yehuda felt he could honor. So Rabbi Yehuda mechabed ashirim, he respected and honored the wealthy. Antoninus, or Antonius, as the Talmud refers to, who we think is Marcus Aurelius, had an incredible relationship with Rabbi Yehuda. Every day he sent him a barrel of gold. And on the top of the barrel he put a little bit of wheat so that the servant carrying the barrel wouldn't be tempted. Rabbi Yehuda said, I have enough of my own, I don't need. And he said, listen, in the next generation, my successors will tax your successors. Put this aside for that. Every day, Marcus Aurelius would visit Rabbi Yehuda in a subterranean tunnel that went from his palace, he kept a palace in Judea, all the way, it wasn't Judea, in fact, Rabbi Yehuda lived in the south, in the north, sorry, in the Galil. He was a subterranean tunnel that went from his palace to Rabbi Yehuda's palace, and as Rashi teaches us, the famous commentary to the Talmud, the purpose of those visits was to study Torah. Now, a king never travels alone, so he took two servants with him every day. But because he doesn't want the servants to know that he's studying Torah, that would be a mark against him in Rome. So what does he do? Well, he comes upon this great idea. And this shows you the morality of the people in Rome in that day. Torah I want to study because it's God's ethic and God's teaching. But the people who come to accompany me, well, they can't survive to tell the tale. So he'd kill one servant when he got to Rabbi Yehuda's side of the tunnel. And then he'd kill the next servant when he returned to his side of the tunnel. And this way, every day, two servants were dead, and he never had to walk alone. So he said to Rabbi Yehuda, I don't want anyone in the house when I visit, because this is supposed to be our secret. And one day, Rabbi Yehuda's student, Hanina ben Chama, is in the house. He says, I told you, nobody's allowed. So Rabbi Yehuda said, this is not a human being. Ein ze yelud isha. He says, what do you mean he's not a human being? He looks human to me. He says, test him, you'll see. So Marcus Aurelius says to Hanina, go please and call for me, summon, the servant I left at the entrance to the tunnel. So he comes and he finds that he's dead. So he's thinking, what should I do? Go back and tell the king that he's dead. He'll suspect I killed him. Should I run away? Then Rabbi Yehuda, suspicion will fall on Rabbi Yehuda. What can I do? So Hanina comes upon a great idea. I'll pray and this dead person will come back to life. No problem. And so he walks back into the palace, into Rabbi Yehuda's house, with this dead man. So Marcus Aurelius says, listen, Rabbi Yehuda, I know that the least among you is capable of reviving the dead, but do me a favor. When I say no one, I mean no one. Just you and I. And so there were all kinds of interesting discussions between Rabbi Yehuda and Marcus Aurelius. He always wanted to serve Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda always refused such service. He said it's not dignified for the king to do that. He wanted to literally get down on all fours so Rabbi Yehuda can use him as a footstool to get up on his bed. Rabbi Yehuda wouldn't allow the king to do that. So Marcus Aurelius said, okay, then at least in eternity, in mortality, I want to be able to serve you. In immortality. So Rabbi Yehuda said, yes, I promise you have a share in the world to come because you are being so kind to the Jewish people. There is, as I said, one tradition that Antoninus, Marcus Aurelius, did convert to Judaism at some point. Some interesting consultations where Marcus Aurelius consulted with Rabbi Yehuda. I'll go through this in detail, but then I'll gloss over the next screen because this is really interesting. There were times that Marcus Aurelius consulted with Rabbi Yehuda about internal Roman politics. Rabbi Yehuda was in a precarious position. To not give advice is to incur the wrath of the king. To give advice is to incur the wrath of his enemies. So he always responded in code so that he can easily deny that he ever advised. At one point, Marcus comes to him and says, listen, I want my son to succeed me, and I also want to absolve the city of Tiberias, of Tiberia, from paying taxes, because he was very impressed with Torah scholars, and Tiberia was primarily a city of Torah scholars. So I know I have enough pull, schlep, or political capital, for one of the two. So which one should I do? So Rabbi Yehuda didn't answer. He wants to get himself into trouble. So Rabbi Yehuda just sends him two people. And he tells the one to sit on the shoulders of the other. And the one sitting on the top should hold a bird. And when they get to the king, the one on the bottom should tell the one on the top, let the bird fly. So Antoninus understood. You work on getting your son to succeed you, and then your son will do what you want him to do in the city of Tiberias. There was once an occasion where there were a number of traitors who threatened Marcus's life, and so he asked Rabbi Yehuda for advice. Rabbi Yehuda wouldn't respond. But Rabbi Yehuda took him out to the garden and started felling trees, one at a time. When one was down, he went to the next. So Marcus understood. Just remove your enemies, but one at a time. Don't take them all on at once, because you won't be able to overcome them. One more time, Marcus asked for advice, because the coffers of Rome were in a very dire situation. They were facing bankruptcy. He wanted to refill the coffers. So Rabbi Yehuda sent a messenger to him with no letter. So Marcus asked him, no letter? Did he do something or say something before you left? He says, yeah, it was odd. He took me into the garden, and he started cutting down big trees and planting little saplings. So Marcus understood that Rabbi Yehuda was suggesting remove judges from their post and then put out their position for tender, and whoever will offer the greatest bribe will be permitted to take that position. Now, this was the kind of advice Rabbi Yehuda could not afford to write in a letter. But when he sends an unwitting messenger who himself doesn't understand the meaning of this communication, then he can probably get away with it because it's deniable. There were a number of debates between Marcus Aurelius and Rabbi Yehuda. In fact, the Talmud records that some of them were won by Marcus Aurelius. One dealt with the question of beginning of life. Does life begin at conception, or does life begin later at formation, or even later at birth? When does the evil inclination take hold or sway of the person? Is it at conception, or is it later at birth? An interesting question was Marcus said, pray for me. And so Rabbi Yehuda said, may God protect you from cold. And Marcus said, that's no prayer, I can just put on a coat. So he said, may God protect you from the heat. And so the king Antoninus, Marcus Aurelius, said, that's a good prayer, because it says, Ein nistar mechamato, no one can hide from his heat. It was before air conditioning became a necessity rather than a luxury. At one point, the king Marcus Aurelius asked Rabbi Yehuda if it's okay to pray every hour. And so Rabbi Yehuda said, it's not respectable to speak to the king every hour. So Marcus disagreed. So the next day, Rabbi Yehuda comes in the morning and he says, peace upon you, your majesty. An hour later, he comes back and says, peace upon you, your majesty. An hour later, he says, peace upon you, your majesty. And Marcus got angry. He says, what are you? You're mocking the king? And Rabbi Yehuda says, let your ears listen to what your mouth just said. Do you understand? You can be mocking the king if you pray frequently. At one point, Marcus asked why the sun sets in the west. So facetiously, Rabbi Yehuda said, if it would set in the east, you'd ask me why in the east. So he says, no, but really, why does it set in the west? He says, because the Holy of Holies was in the west of the Beit HaMikdash, and so the sun is bowing to God. So Marcus says, that's a good answer, but why doesn't it just go to midpoint, at midday, bow a little bit, and continue backwards? So Rabbi Yehuda said, this is for the purpose of those returning home from work, so it should be a longer day. An interesting exchange. At one point, Marcus came to Rabbi Yehuda on Shabbos and received a meal with cold food. Rabbi Yehuda said, listen, come back during the week, I'll give you a nice warm meal. Comes back during the week, he eats the warm food, and he says, I actually like the cold food better. Rabbi Yehuda said to him, a similar story is told of Rabbi Yeshua with Hadrian. Rabbi Yehuda said to him, well, on Shabbos we have an ingredient that we ran out of today. He says, what, the king's house lacks ingredients? I could just order the ingredient to be brought. He says, this ingredient you can't order. It's called Shabbos. When Antoninus died, when Marcus Aurelius died, Rabbi Yehuda mourned him and said, Nitparda hachavila, the bond is undone. He felt that the two of them shared a special bond. Rabbi Yehuda was a very pious man. He refused to accept slander of any sort. even the positive. One day his son complimented the scribe who wrote a particular book, and Rabbi Yehuda said to him, if you compliment him one day, you accustom yourself to speaking of someone, the next day when you don't like his work, you'll criticize him. Better don't say either. One day Rabbi Chiya, there are two stories about Rabbi Chiya. One of the stories is that Rabbi Yehuda was really impressed with the work Rabbi Chiya did to travel from city to city and teach the youth Torah. And he said, Rabbi Chiya's work is greater even than my own, which is an incredible statement for the greatest teacher of the generation. And Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yossi, this is Yishmael, the son of his colleague, of Rabbi Meir's colleague, Rabbi Yossi. This Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yossi had an interesting story. One day when he came to Rabbi Akiva to study, it was his first day and he didn't know the etiquette. As soon as Rabbi Yehuda would walk into the academy, everyone would take their seat. Rabbi Shmuel was a very hefty man and he found it hard to find a spot big enough for him. I remember a story of a particular rabbi I know who has a similar predicament, so whenever he flies, he always reserves two seats, not one. And so one day he came to his plane and he says, this can't be my seat, I reserved two seats. And the flight attendant says to him, that's right, Rabbi, one here and the other's there. So Rabbi Shmuel couldn't find a seat large enough for him. So the person in charge of etiquette came up to him and says, who do you think you are? Who are you? What brings you here? He says, I came to study Torah from Rabbi Yehuda. So angry by his lack of etiquette, he says, what, do you think you're worthy of studying from Rabbi Yehuda? So Rabbi Shmuel retorts, do you think Moshe was worthy of studying from God? You obviously don't have to be worthy to study Torah. And so this Rabbi Shmuel said to Rabbi Yehuda, what do you think? Is Rabbi Chiya's work better even than your own father? He says, no, not my father, but it's greater than my own. So one day Rabbi Shmuel says to him, this great Rabbi Chiya you're speaking of, he's not very well mannered. I saw him in the bathhouse and he didn't even greet me. So Rabbi Yehuda calls Rabbi Chiya and he says, I think so highly of you. Why don't you greet your colleagues? He says, I was so engrossed in my Torah studies that I didn't notice him. What's Rabbi Yehuda thinking? If Rabbi Chiya walks into the bathhouse so engrossed and doesn't notice someone even as large as Rabbi Shmuel, then he can trip, he can fall, he can hurt himself. So Rabbi Yehuda assigns two students to walk with Rabbi Chiya every time he goes to the bathhouse just to protect him. That's what Rabbi Yehuda is worried about. At one point, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Chiya were walking together, and they come to a city, and Rabbi Yehuda says, listen, I want to go visit the Torah scholars in this city. Rabbi Chiya says, you should stay in the hotel, let them visit you. You're the Nasi, you're the president. So in the end, Rabbi Yehuda went anyway, and this scholar gave them an incredible blessing, thanking Rabbi Yehuda for coming. And Rabbi Yehuda said to Rabbi Chiya, had I only taken your advice, you would have deprived me of this blessing. The Talmud tells us, that Eliyahu often visited the academy of Rabbi Akiva because he was a very pious man deserving of the revelation of Elijah. And at one point on Rosh Chodesh, Elijah came late. And so Rabbi Yehuda said to him, why did you come late? You know, my principal used to say the same thing. You're 5 minutes late, but I'm not Elijah. Even though I thought I was more important than Elijah. Nevertheless, Elijah says to him, today is Rosh Chodesh. It's the beginning of the month. And Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov come to pray before God. So I am the one who brings them. I have to wake them, wash their hands, bring them over. And I can't bring them all together. I have to bring each one separately. So it takes time. So Rabbi Yehuda says, why can't you bring them all together? He says, because then God couldn't deny their prayer. The power of their prayer would be so tremendous that God couldn't overcome it. And if they would ask for the Mashiach to come, God would have to honor their request. So he doesn't allow them to pray all at once. So Rabbi Yehuda said, is there anyone like that here on earth? And Eliyahu told him, yes, Chiya and his children. So the next time when it came to praying because there was a drought, Rabbi Yehuda put Rabbi Chiya and his sons up to lead the service. And as soon as they started praying, the clouds gathered and the rain started falling. I tell the story primarily because I want to demonstrate that Eliyahu was a frequent visitor in Rabbi Yehuda's academy. The Talmud says that Rabbi Yehuda would say the Shema very quickly. And others would take their time. Shema is an important proclamation of faith. And the Talmud says it's not because Rabbi Yehuda took it lightly, but it took him just as long as it takes you to run your hand across your forehead. That's how long it took him to remember the yoke of God and to feel the reverence in his heart and soul, because he was never far from that level of reverence. I mentioned before that Rabbi Yehuda was called HaKadosh, the Holy One. The Talmud tells us, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, he said, I've never looked down at my circumcision. meaning I've never looked at the nether regions of my body. And the Talmud says, though he was married, he never allowed his hands to stray below his belt. Rabbi Yehuda once said that if Huna, the exile ark from Babel, from Babylon, comes to Israel, I would have to abdicate my throne and give it to him because he is a descendant of King David. Rabbi Yehuda was a descendant of King David through his mother. And succession, tribal succession, follows through the father. And Huna, the exile ark, was in the succession through the father from King David. So Chia looks out the window and says, "Ah, Huna's outside!" So Rabbi Yehuda's face turned green. The Midrash tells us this. Because he was prepared to do it, but he really didn't want to. And so Rabbi Chia said, "But he's here in a coffin. He's here to be buried." So Rabbi Yehuda said to Chia, "Go out and see if there's anyone looking for you." So Rabbi Chia goes out and there was no one looking for him. So he understood that Rabbi Yehuda had banned him from the academy for this little joke he played. And Rabbi Chia stayed out for 30 days. And then he returned. The Talmud says that when Rabbi Yehuda died, true humility died with him. From there on out, we only emulate the trait of humility, but true humility, Rabbi Yehuda was the last such specimen. Rabbi Yehuda suffered greatly during his life. And again, we'll try to gloss over some of this a little more quickly than we have. Rabbi Lazar ben Shimon, who was his former colleague, I told you the story of how Rabbi Lazar was a greater scholar than Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Lazar died early also because he had suffered greatly with incredible illness. And Rabbi Yehuda wanted to marry Rabbi Lazar's widow. And so she sent back to him and said, "No, the vessel that was used for holiness should now be used for mundane," meaning my former husband is far greater than you. And another version is that she said, "The hook upon which the warrior hangs his sword should later be used by the shepherd for his bag," meaning my husband was the warrior, in comparison you're just the shepherd. So he wrote back saying, "Okay, I know he was the greater Torah scholar, he demonstrated that. But what about his piety and his behavior? Aren't I at least on par with him there?" So she said, "No, my husband suffered, and when you suffer, you are at the highest level in God's eyes." So Rabbi Yehuda said, "If suffering is great, then I'll invite suffering upon myself." And so the Talmud tells us he had 13 years of illness, 6 years of scurvy and 7 years of gallstones, or the reverse, 7 years of scurvy and 6 years of gallstones. When he urinated, when he went to the bathroom, he would cry so loudly that they could hear him out in the ocean. And even though his stable hands used to feed the horses during that time and they would kick up a ruckus and you can hear them from a distance, you can still hear Rabbi Yehuda's cries of pain. But the Talmud tells us that this illness didn't just come. It happened because of a story. One day Rabbi Yehuda was teaching and a calf was being brought along in front of Rabbi Yehuda's house or square where he was teaching. A calf was being led to its slaughter. And the calf ran away from its leader and came to hide in Rabbi Yehuda's cloak or in his robes. Rabbi Yehuda said to him, "Go, go, go on, little calf. This is what you were formed for. This is why you were created. Lekach notzarta." And then from heaven they said, "He has so little compassion on God's creatures, we should show him what it's like to suffer a little bit." 13 years later, his maid was cleaning the house, and she saw this little nest of weasels. And so she wanted to get rid of it. And Rabbi Yehuda said, "No, leave it alone. It says, Barachamav al kol ma'asav. God is compassionate upon all of his creatures." And so she left it alone, and then his suffering lifted because he demonstrated his compassion for God's creatures. Nevertheless, when a tzaddik suffers, it brings great merit to the generation because God views the generation as a whole and he says, "I cannot possibly punish this generation because a great tzaddik is already being punished." And so during the course of his suffering for those 13 years, there was not a single day of rain in Israel. And nevertheless, when you'd pull a cucumber from the ground, it would immediately, the hole, the vacuum that was left, would immediately fill with water. That the water, the earth retained its water so well, despite the fact that there was never rain. And the Talmud tells us that the day of rain is the day of judgment, because God always has to determine whether we are worthy of rain. And our sages said, if we didn't need rain that badly, we would pray that God stop this whole business of rain. And furthermore, there were no birth pangs. Women did not experience birth pangs. Imagine that, ladies. And no one miscarried during the course of those 13 years, the Talmud testifies. So Rabbi Yehuda was a pious man, and he suffered greatly during the course of his life. Rabbi Yehuda wrote the Mishnah, or actually led the effort to edit and to redact the Mishnah. He, of course, there was, until that point, a prohibition against recording the transmitted word of God, only the written word of God could be written, but the oral tradition had to be transmitted orally. And so Rabbi Yehuda used the verse in Tehillim, Eit la asot la Hashem, a time to do for God, heferu Torah techa, uproot your Torah. That is a very dangerous verse to use because you can uproot the Torah with any justification and claim that it's for the sake of God. But it takes a man of Rabbi Yehuda's stature to persuade the scholars of his generation that in this case, it is a correct thing to do to uproot the tradition and to record the Torah for the purpose of preserving it. And this would be the only opportunity because you couldn't expect such a lull in the next generation. Rabbi Yehuda had an incredible relationship with, as we mentioned before, Marcus Aurelius. And that enabled him to take the few years that it would take to write the Mishnah. And it was concluded in the year 188. He called for a national convention of all the scholars. All of the laws that were known to each of the scholars were reviewed. Any dispute was debated, was analyzed. Finally, votes were taken. And those votes were reflected in the Mishnah that Rabbi Yehuda wrote. He rendered the Mishnah using texts that Rabbi Meir had written before him. And it was sort of informal notes that Rabbi Meir had written. And Rabbi Yehuda edited those notes. And Rabbi Yehuda was the one who decided. He decided if this one was right or this one was wrong. In the end, their votes were taken, but Rabbi Yehuda was the final determining authority. He was the editor of the Mishnah. He rarely ever did he quote himself. His name appears in the Mishnah 3 times in total. So he never took advantage of his authority, of his position. His own opinion was often overruled by others, and that is to say he allowed others to overrule because he had the final signing authority. He was the editor-in-chief. And he wrote the Mishnah in very poetic Palestinian Hebrew. The Mishnah is written in incredible language. Now, Rabbi Yehuda was a linguist, and in his house he spoke Hebrew and also Greek. Because it is said that in the house of the Nasi, throughout Hillel's dynasty, they taught their children Greek. And Rabbi Yehuda said, if you can't speak Hebrew, speak Greek. No other language is worthy of our time and of our effort. I wonder what he would have thought of French. Maybe English. No, just kidding. So Rabbi Yehuda's maid was so fluent in Hebrew that the sages learned some Hebrew words from his maid. They didn't know what a salsala is. And the word appears in the books of our prophets, salsala. And one day they saw somebody combing his hair, and the maid was saying, how long will you be misalsel besarecha? How long will you comb your hair? So they understood that salsala means a comb. They also didn't know what sirugin means. There's a word in the Mishnah that if you read the Megillah, besirugin, sirugin we know today means, if you read it in parts, you read a part of it, you stop, you read another part of it. So one day they saw Rabbi Yehuda's maid saw these sages coming to his home in waves. So she got upset. She says, why don't you all come at once? Why are you coming to sirugin? So they understood what sirugin means. So that demonstrates the fluency of Hebrew in Rabbi Yehuda's home, that the sages of his day had to learn Hebrew from his maid, who was not known specifically for her scholarship, but she picked up Hebrew because she lived in Rabbi Yehuda's home. His last will and testament. Rabbi Chiya, his student, came to visit him when he was on his deathbed and he saw Rabbi Yehuda crying. So Rabbi Chiya said to him, why are you crying? We read and that we know from the Talmud that a person that dies with tears, it's a negative sign. That means that he has reason to be worried about his destiny after life. A person that dies with a smile, it's a positive sign. And the Talmud gives us all kinds of positive and negative signs. We mentioned last week about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. If he dies facing the wall, it's a negative sign because he has something to be ashamed about. If he dies facing the people, then it's a positive sign. If he dies on a Friday, it's a positive sign. If he dies on a Motza'ei Yom Kippur, right after Yom Kippur, it's a positive sign because he comes to heaven completely absolved from all sins. So he said, why are you crying? That's a negative sign. So Rabbi Yehuda said, I'm not crying for my loss of my life, but I'm crying for the loss of the Torah and mitzvah that I will no longer be able to study and to fulfill once I'm dead. So Rabbi Chiya said, that's a good reason to cry. Then Rabbi Yehuda calls in his sons and he said, Labanai ani tzarech, I need my sons. Shimon and Gamliel were his 2 sons. And he told them, what did he say before he died? He said, Izaharu bichvod imchem, be careful with the honor of your mother. Now that I'll be gone, who will look after her honor? It falls to you to make sure that she's well looked after and she's well respected. He said, I always want you to have a candle burning and the table set and my bed prepared. And the Talmud tells us that posthumously, on Friday evening, he would come and make Kiddush for his family. And then when word got out, he stopped doing that. Why? Because he didn't want to make it seem that he was the only one meritorious enough to be given permission to return to visit with his family. And that would cast aspersions on all the other rabbis who died before him and didn't visit with their family. So he stopped once word got out. An incredible, mind-blowing concept that posthumously he would come back Friday evening to make Kiddush. He then said that his two personal servants, Yosef Chafni and Shimon Efrati, should serve him after he dies. So everyone thought it meant that they should be involved in his funeral arrangements. But it turned out that they died just before he did. So it was understood that they were to be his servants in heaven after he died. And why did he pre-tell this? Why did he predict this? So the Talmud tells us so that no one should think that they were really sinners who should have died earlier, and that they had only remained alive because Rabbi Yehuda had prayed for them because he needed them to serve him. So Rabbi Yehuda wanted to undermine that type of thinking, and so he said that the reason they're dying is to serve me in the afterlife. He then said, Gamliel, my oldest son, should be the Nasi and not Shimon. The Nasi means the president. So the Talmud says Shimon was the wiser of the two. So why should Gamliel be the Nasi? Despite the fact that he's the oldest one. But why should he be the Nasi? So the Talmud says, because he was the more pious of the two. Rabbi Yehuda placed a greater emphasis on piety than he did on scholarship. And then he said, Hanina ben Chama. You remember him, he's the one who prayed and revived that servant in the subterranean tunnel. He said, he should be the dean. Turned out that it took 2.5 years before Hanina became the dean because he refused to lead the academy as long as his colleague Rabbi Alphus was alive. And he felt Rabbi Alphus was more well suited to the position. 2.5 years later, Rabbi Alphus passed away and Hanina in fact became the dean. He then called in his son Shimon and gave him the order of wisdom. He taught him the secrets of how to pursue and to discern from the Torah, to glean from the Torah the information that one needs to glean. And then the Talmud doesn't tell us the details of these orders, but the Talmud does tell us the order of leadership that he gave to his son Gamliel. He said, I want you to lead your presidency with a raised arm. In other words, be strong. And Zrok Marab Talmidim, make sure the students fear you. So the Talmud says, what do you mean? Didn't Rabbi Yehuda stand in front of the students when they walked in? And he hugged them and he kissed them and he cared for them. So the Talmud says, no. These are the instructions that they're meant to receive for the public eye. But in private, you should demonstrate your love and your respect for them. And this again demonstrates Rabbi Yehuda's seeming conflict of personality, such a humble, loving, susceptible to tears type person. And on the other hand, such a powerful leader whose word was respected by all. Rabbi Yehuda tried to explain to his son, you have to cultivate an aura and a personality in order for the purpose of the office that you inhabit, but you must never allow it to get to your head, and even your students should be well respected by you and loved and cared for by you. His actual passing. The sages prayed up a storm, so to speak, when they saw Rabbi Yehuda was on his deathbed, and they decreed that no man may tell that Rabbi Yehuda passed away. And by this, they hoped to say that Rabbi Yehuda can't pass, because no man may come back and communicate the fact of his passing. And because they prayed so hard, Rabbi Yehuda, despite his illness, simply hung on to life. And so his maid, the same maid that we heard of before, his maid began to pray and say, Lord of the universe, his bed is being demanded, being claimed by the supernal and by the lower beings. May it be your will that the higher beings overcome the lower beings. Take him already. I see he's suffering. Why did she see he's suffering? Because he had extreme diarrhea or dysentery. He had difficulties, and he was going to the bathroom every moment, every few minutes. And every time he came out of the bathroom, he put on his tefillin. And every time he went back to the bathroom, he took off his tefillin. Now, even though a person in that condition is not required to wear tefillin, Rabbi Yehuda was a very pious man and did not want to stay even a moment in his day without tefillin. Today, we never wear our tefillin outside of actual prayer times, but in those days, people would wear their tefillin all day. Taking it off and putting it back on in his weakened condition was very hard for him, so she felt bad and she prayed that he die. which is one more example used in the Talmud that is permissible to take some form of action to bring along, to encourage one's demise. But again, it's not a halacha, it's a agada. It's a story, and it's difficult to determine actual law from the story in the Talmud. But here she took a spiritual step by praying to God that he succumbed to his illness. But because the rabbis continued to pray, Rabbi Yehuda persisted stubbornly to life, clung stubbornly to life. Well, the maid decided to take matters into her own hands. She went up on the deck and she dropped this big crystal bowl, and the resultant crash just distracted the rabbis for a moment, and at that moment Rabbi Yehuda died. So after they continued praying, not knowing Rabbi Yehuda died, they sent one of their members, Bar Kapara, they sent him, one of Rabbi Yehuda's students, to see what's going on, how Rabbi Yehuda's feeling. And he came and he saw that he had died, but the sages had decreed that no one may tell that Rabbi Yehuda died. So he immediately rent his garment, as one is required to do when your teacher has passed away. But he turned the rent to the back of wore his shirt backwards, and he walked back to the academy, and they said, "What's going on?" So he said, poetically, he said, "Rabbi Yehuda's coffin is claimed by the angels and by the grounded ones, mitzukim, those who are grounded in this world. And the er-elim, the angels, have overcome the grounded ones. Natzchu ha-er-elim et ha-mitzukim." And you'll often, if you're in Israel and you see one of those proclamations that someone has passed away, this is a very common phrase that's used, Natzchu ha-er-elim et ha-mitzukim. So they said to him, "Does this mean Rabbi Yehuda died?" And he said, "You said that, I didn't say that." Because he wasn't permitted to actually report that. But that's how they found out that he passed away. It is said that as Rabbi Yehuda passed away, he lifted his 10 fingers. And the mystics teach us that the soul actually exits through the fingertips. So he lifted his 10 fingers and he said, "Ribbono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, it is well known and revealed before you that with my 10 fingers I have studied hard and toiled to understand your Torah. And not even my small finger has taken pleasure from all of the wonderful largesse you have shared with me and the wealth you've bestowed upon me. May it be your will that my rest be peaceful." And that a voice echoed down from heaven saying, "Indeed, may you return in peace and may you lie in peace forever." And with that, Rabbi Yehuda passed away. It was declared at that moment that the priestly restrictions against attending a funeral will be lifted in Rabbi Yehuda's honor, because it is said in the Talmud that a great righteous person, when he passes away, there is no impurity associated with his deathbed. And that doesn't mean that there is no impurity per se. It means that the priests overrule their restrictions and participate in the funeral despite the fact that they would have to become impure as a result of that. It is also said that on that day, a voice echoed down from heaven saying that everyone who participated in Rabbi Akiva's, in Rabbi Yehuda's funeral has a share in the world to come. And so there was a simple fellow. He did Rabbi Yehuda's laundry and he visited him every day. Rabbi Yehuda was a wealthy man. He could afford to have the launderer come every day. And that day he didn't visit. I suppose he felt, you know, everybody is so sick and praying, nobody's worrying about their underwear. And so he didn't come. And he heard this echo coming from heaven and said, "My goodness, I lost my opportunity, my share in the world to come." He was so devastated, he climbed to the roof and threw himself to his death. And so a voice came from heaven saying, "This man too has a share in the world to come." That day there was a great miracle. The sun set late in the day. It was Erev Shabbos. I mentioned before that if a person that passes away on a Friday afternoon, that's a good sign. So it was Friday afternoon, and they had the funeral on that day, and people came from all over, from far and wide. And then they had to return home and make their final preparations for Shabbos. The Talmud says the sun didn't set until the last person returned home and was ready for Shabbos. And as soon as the sun set, the rooster crowed. So people were worried that maybe they in fact violated Shabbos as a result of going to the funeral. And so another voice came from heaven again that said, "Anyone who participated in eulogizing Rabbi Yehuda has a share in the world to come." So an incredible story about his passing. And again, when it comes to the Talmud, it's very difficult to understand exactly which parts to take literally and which parts to understand poetically. But I share the stories with you as they appear in the Talmud. And we're reaching the very last part of the series. I think we actually just finished it. Yes, correct. So that really brings us to the end of the story of Rabbi Yehuda. It brings us to the end of our session of the Sages of the Talmud. What I hope that you've been able to glean from all of the four sessions and all of the many characters that we've reviewed is that these were men, giants of Torah scholarship, but also incredibly humble and generous and peace-loving people. They are often given a very negative reputation, a very negative characterization as control-hungry rabbis that wanted to keep the population under their control, and that's why they formulated all these laws that make no sense and have no reason but for establishing and grounding their authority and their control. That speculation just simply is not consistent with the picture that we try to form for you here and the description of their characters and personality. These great men of our history who literally saved Judaism for us, if not for them, then we would become Babylonian or Roman or whatnot, Greek or assimilated in any other culture that we become a part of, including Egyptian. If not for them, we would not be who we are today. God sends the right people for the right time, for the right purpose. And what we clearly see from here is that their dedication was literally to the Torah and not to their own aggrandizement. As we heard before when we talked about Rabban Gamliel, he was very clear when he stated, "I did none of this for my own glory. Never did I consider the glory of my father's home. I did it all for the sake of God and of the Jewish people." So I want to thank everyone for coming tonight and for participating in the lecture series, and specifically I want to thank Manny for helping us with the slide presentation. Yashar koach, everyone.